Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order August 24th, 2021, for the 1 o'clock meeting. With me today is Senator Bishop, Senator Hoffman in person, online, should be.
Senator Olson.
Yep, Senator Olson, my list is off. So those online, could you speak up, please?
Bill
Wilkowski. Okay, we got Senator Wilkowski.
Senator Wilson.
And Senator Wilson. Okay, and in the room we have Senator Stevens, and Senator Stevens was in the morning meeting the whole time. I apologize, I neglected to mention that on the record. This afternoon, we have one issue to come before the committee. It's Senate Bill 3001, an act making appropriations from the general fund to the Department of Education and Early Development for the payment of education programs, making an appropriation from the earnings reserve account for the payment of permanent fund dividends, making an appropriation from the earnings reserve account to the budget reserve fund, and providing for an effective date. And we have with us today Mr. Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget for the administration. If he could come forward, take us through the bill, and we'll probably have some discussion on some of these contents. You know, so we will have, I think Mr. Steininger, the bill is pretty short, so I think I'll have him just walk through the bill, and then we'll back up and kind of go through our questions. If that's amenable to the committee, and we can talk about the component parts. Okay, Mr. Steininger, can you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and tell us what this bill does?
Thank you. For the record, Neil Steininger with the Office of Management and Budget, and thank you for introducing me here today to speak on SB 3001, the appropriation bill that accompanies the rest of the administration's fiscal plan proposal. So the administration's objective in the special session is the enactment of a fiscal plan. There are several components to that fiscal plan, some of which require appropriations. That fiscal plan includes constitutionally protecting the permanent fund dividend, and the power cost equalization program and fund, establishing meaningful limits to the growth of expenditures, and providing for a bridge to a sustainable fiscal plan. Some of those components are addressed in this appropriation bill where appropriations are required, but this appropriation bill also addresses a couple of other items that are the result of the fiscal year 22 budget just simply not being completed yet. There are several outstanding issues in the fiscal year 22 budget, one of which is the calendar year 2021 or fiscal year 22 permanent fund dividend. This issue is resolved in SB 3001. There's also impacts related to the sweep, the lack of a three-quarter vote on HB 69, the fiscal year 22 budget. Those impacts included the power cost equalization endowment. However, that was resolved by a recent court case, the Alaska Federation of Natives case, which resolved that issue, and now power cost equalization endowment related appropriations have been released and we're beginning expenditure on those items. However, other things are still related to the impacts of that three-quarter vote, including higher education scholarship programs and grant programs. Those are resolved here in SB 3001, but there's also other operating and capital budget shortfalls that are not addressed in 3001 that require resolution in one form or another. There's an attachment to this presentation with a list of those items, if the committee would like to go through that at some point in the presentation.
Okay, so we have only four slides here, so I think we're gonna do a little different. Let's just let you roll through the four slides and then we'll come back to slide number two. That way you can have a opportunity to present what you wanna present to the Finance Committee virtually uninterrupted, but we'll have numerous questions on all the component parts.
All right. Thank you. So slide 3 is a little bit repetitive of slide 2, but this is just laying out the elements of SB 3001. There's an appropriation of $1.53 billion for the payment of the 2021 permanent fund dividend. This is based on 50% of the percent of market value draw from the earnings reserve, provides an estimated $2,350 for every eligible Alaskan. And this is consistent with the other proposals that are part of the overall fiscal plan that's been presented to the legislature by the administration. And there's also a section appropriating unrestricted general funds for the Alaska Student Scholarships and Grant Programs. So they're the Performance Scholarship Awards, the Alaska Education Grants, and the WAMI Medical Education Program. These three items are represented when you look in the actual bill itself. In that first section, there are $0 values next to these items. Those $0 are because we are swapping the fund source used to pay for that program from a fund subject to the sweep to unrestricted general funds, which will have revenue to backs of appropriations. So just, you know, as a lay person looking through this bill, they appear zeros, but in sections 2 and 3 of the appropriation bill, you can see where that fund change is being made. There's also a deposit into the constitutional budget reserve from the earnings reserve account of $1.47 billion. This, combined with that permanent fund dividend payment, makes up your $3 billion bridge fund that the Department of Revenue has been explaining in some of their presentations on the overall fiscal plan. And this is what allows for that bridge to the sustainable fiscal plan that's been discussed in the various components introduced by the administration. On slide 4, and this relates to the handout that details these impacts, there are different impacts of the failure of a three-quarter CBR vote in HB 69. There's immediate issues. So some of these are resolved in SB 3001 with the backfill of unrestricted general funds. These are the scholarships and education grants. And those issues truly are immediate. Some of these students are currently attending university. On September 1st, WAMI students, if there's no appropriation made, we'll begin to receive bills reflecting out-of-state tuition. And that, if no appropriation is made prior to December, they will have to pay those. But if we have an appropriation made in the intervening time period, they'll receive a discount from that billed amount. But September 1st, those students will begin to receive those bills. So these are truly immediate impacts on individual Alaskans. But there's also some delayed issues. There are unfunded capital projects, and those projects simply will be delayed until a valid funding source is appropriated or the current funding source has revenue to back those appropriations. And then partially funded operating items. Most of those, if you look at the accompanying sheet here, it shows you the percent of the overall operating budget impacted by these shortfalls due to the sweep. Most of those programs have those impacts. Hits them in the third or fourth quarter of the fiscal year. And so while that's still an operational problem that needs to be resolved, it's not an operational problem that has immediate impact today. And there are different legislative options that exist to address those shortfalls. And with that, I'll open up to questions.
Okay, so let's go back to page 2. So the preference is a third special session on a durable fiscal plan. And I'm not quite sure how to get that through the system in 2 weeks. So can you talk to us a little about this constitutionally protected permanent fund concept, and then we'll go from there, and then we'll go into the bridge funding, or we can even do the expenditure growth issue.
Chair Stedman, I'm here today to talk mostly about SB 371, the appropriation bill to accompany those. And I think for a really thorough discussion, particularly of the constitutional protection of the permanent fund dividend, and the PC programs through SJR 6, I think it would be good to have Commissioner Mahoney come and give the very thorough presentation that she was able to give to the working group over the last several weeks to explain the details of that program and the modeling that the Department of Revenue has done on those issues.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, with all due respect, you are the OMB director, the person that's been around for the longest period of time as far as finances go, and so we tend to go ahead and like your breadth of expertise as well as your experience on both the administrative side and the legislative side. With all due respect, Commissioner Mahoney's just an appointee, so her depth of understanding and her ability to go ahead and explain what's really trying to happen does not have the longevity of somebody that's been in the system for a long period of time. And as was pointed out by this morning's Senate Finance Committee meeting, the finance members have been in the legislature for a long period of time, and we've seen a lot of these pipe dreams come down the way how the budget's going to be balanced in 2025 with the bridge loan or whatever else. And because of that, I would say that if you have any ability to go ahead and give us some shade of an answer, I would appreciate it. Commissioner Mahoney is a good person, but I think that her short period of time in the administration is not something we're looking for. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think one of the points that Senator Olson's bringing up, and Senator Olson obviously is online, and I think Senator Von Imhoff's online also, as mentioned earlier by Senator Hoffman, this is probably the most seasoned Senate Finance Committee in the history of the state. And we've dealt with a lot of different issues from multiple angles. So we have concerns on what we've seen presented and, you know, what we've read in news releases. Second bullet you got on establishing meaningful limits of expenditure growth. My understanding and looking at the past record since FY16, we virtually had no growth. It's been going sideways in our operatings, both statewide and agencies. And my expectation is for the next few years, it's not going to change. So what's the issue with the establishing of meaningful spending limits when we actually have one on the table right now? It's a 5% cap of the earnings reserve, with a permanent, or 5% payout of the from the permanent fund. That is our spending cap. And that's what we ran up against. And that's why the dividend came through the budgetary process at $1,100. So help me understand why we would be, what we're trying to deal with here.
Chair Stedman, on the establishing meaningful limits to the expenditure growth, we have SJR 5, which is a amendment to the constitutional appropriation limit. And I apologize, I don't have my presentation on that with me. I came prepared to talk about 3001. However, you know, when you look at the historic trend on our current appropriation limit and kind of prior events that have happened, if and when the state's revenue situation changes, if we have a windfall, or we have a rise in oil prices, or some other revenue come online that expands the availability of revenue, that's the concern, is that our current appropriation limit won't stop us from just spending all of that revenue. If you look at the history, there's only two fiscal years in which our current appropriation limit was actually below total revenue available for expenditure. And so the concern is that our appropriation limit right now, if we have, you know, the good news event of an expansion in revenue, that our current appropriation limit won't be able to prevent a run-up in increased spending. And as we all know over the experience of the last decade, trying to rein that spending back in is very challenging. So part of our durable fiscal plan is to put in place an appropriation limit that would prevent that, you know, exponential run-up in spending should revenue, you know, turn around and we have more revenue available to the state. So it's not so much that, you know, right now, today, we don't have a meaningful limit on expenditures in the form of, you know, just not enough revenue to spend. It's more looking to the future where the current, you know, situation the state is in today has changed and ensuring that, you know, there are meaningful constraints on those changes in the future. And that's really the philosophy behind that proposal.
Right. And we'll go on here to the bridge funding here in a minute, but there's no forecast that the committee's seeing that we're going to have massive surpluses coming in front of us at all, from any direction, from anybody. We were up against the spending limit this year, and some folks didn't like that because they wanted more expenditures to come out of the Treasury. So we will be up against a spending limit next year, which is the 5%. And the projections that we've seen so far, without the American Recovery Act, we'd be 135 or so million underwater, thereabouts, or some numbers. So we'll be using the American Recovery Act money and converting it to GF so we can have a balanced budget next year. So we'll have the discussion in those issues this winter at this table. But constitutional changes aren't ripe until May for an election in the fall. We have many, many months in front of us to work through these issues. So the having the legislature convened in Juneau in special session, straining our budget to produce something that doesn't have to be produced till May is definitely questionable, and we'll be working on it this winter. The bridge financing, there's concern with that issue as far as most bridge financing you get paid back. This is a overdraw of the permanent fund in any way you measure it at $3 billion. And why would we, why should we consider in this scenario advancing $3 billion, or you could cut it another way, the little over $1.5 billion, roughly to split it in half for the dividends. But why would we transfer that amount of money to the CBR years in advance? And why is that germane over the next year? Because there is, again, no models or presentations that I've seen that we're going to run out of cash in the next year. So what's the urgency of this bridge funding other than politics?
Chair Stedman, so the bridge funding is there, you know, it is there in order for us to sort of weather through until revenues increase or other changes can be made that bring the fiscal plan into balance, and that's several years out. And I do understand your question of why now and why not, you know, a year from now. The idea is that if we enact all of these elements of the fiscal plan, you know, before they go to the voters, as we put them to the voters, that we would still follow those rules, even though they haven't been enacted by the voters, but to show as a more or less a show of face that this plan works, this is what we're sticking to. And so in order to avoid any, you know, additional draw over the 5% from the earnings reserve, we need money to go to. You know, some estimates have the CBR going below $1 billion in terms of available assets with, you know, given appropriations. And so that is too low of a balance for long-term sustainability of the CBR to act as a as our working capital account. And so this transfer would allow us to make it from now until the point at which the models balance. Doing it now allows us to follow the rules of this durable fiscal plan that we would enact to follow those rules in advance of them being voted on by the people of Alaska to show that this plan does work. And so that's why we have the bridge fund happening now rather than waiting. The bridge fund's necessary, and it's not a, this is not a recurring excess draw from the earnings reserve. It's a one-time draw as a piece of an overall plan. Once the constitutional protection of the earnings reserve as part of that first bullet occurs, we won't have access to any other funds other than the CBR and a handful of designated general funds. And so those assets are just necessary for the basic financial health of the state going forward.
All right. The concern is the plan is deficient and doesn't add up. Senator Bishop.
I'll pass. I calm down.
I have questions.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Mr. Steiniger, thank you for coming in and talking about SB 3001. And so I will keep my questions specifically to this bill. You had stated that you didn't necessarily want to talk about things beyond this bill, but to me, part of the job of presenting a bill is to discuss its impacts of its provisions under multiple lenses, whether it be political or fiscal or economic. And in this particular case, we should be discussing the trade-offs. So, for example, if we're going to take $1.53 billion for the payment of a dividend, the trade-offs would be that we would not be paying for many of the other vetoes, because I see that the governor has put in three vetoes pertaining to the Alaska Student Scholarship Grants. What was not put in was public health nursing, the Alaska travel industry, and I thought tourism was our bright spot and a revenue, we're trying to dream up new revenue. Hundreds of millions of dollars in Department of Transportation projects, REAA funding, school funding, Alaska vocational upgrades to help educate our workforce, which I think is very critical. So, Mr. Steiniger, what are the economic impacts to the state as well as to the individuals by not funding those particular projects? Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'd like to clarify one thing first. The education programs, the education grant, the scholarship program, and WAMI, none of those items were vetoed from the governor's bill. The governor has supported those items and included them in every appropriation bill we've put forward of this administration. The reason that they need to be addressed here in HB 3001 is because they are the original appropriations were made from a fund subject to the sweep. And because there wasn't a three-quarter vote on the CBR provisions of HB 69, those programs sit unfunded. And so because those three programs, as well as a permanent fund dividend, are the programs with the most immediate and direct impact on individual Alaskans, that's why you see them supported here in this bill. The thing I will note, though, is that shouldn't necessarily be interpreted as a lack of support for the other programs that are tied up in the issue of the sweep. However, the other programs don't necessarily have that immediate impact on individual Alaskans. And so they have possibly, with some of them, the ability to sort of weather things out for a more robust solution. In our bill that we put forward last December, that solution was including the reverse sweep. Since that didn't get passed, we're looking at what solutions can be made for other programs. Some of them have very small shortfalls, some have very large shortfalls. Some cannot go forward at all. But we are looking at, the appropriate avenue to address those. And as I said earlier, our objective for this special session is really to focus work and the effort on the fiscal plan. Really to that end, we only addressed in this bill those things related to the fiscal plan and those things with immediate individual Alaskans impacted. But that's not to say that there's no support for those other items that are subject to the sweep. It's just we are looking at other opportunities and other avenues to resolve those issues.
Follow up. Thank you. I would push back and say REAA school funding is pretty immediate. I think kids went back to school this week. Don't know what the conditions are. Some of their schools, whether there's HVAC issues, leaky roofs or what have you. Those are pretty immediate. And I would say the public health nursing is pretty immediate. Front page of the paper every single day showing about ICU beds being pretty full. I think that we're dealing with a crisis right now of people trying to rush to try to get vaccinated right now. I think we saw one of the Diamond Mall here in my district opening up a free vaccination clinic. So I would think, Mr. Scheininger, that you may want to sharpen your pencil and rethink what's a priority or not. Thank you.
So on the, seeing no other questions, on the reverse sweep.
I do have a question, Mr. Chair. This is Senator Wilson.
Senator Wilson, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Scheininger, you mentioned that there is a fund source switch because the sweep did not happen. I have a two-part question. The first part, I guess, has the department, OMB, have you began to enact the sweep in terms of changing fund sources and to closing out some of those accounts? And I guess the second part would be, does the administration feel that the reverse sweep is not happening, or are you advocating for the reverse sweep to just continue to be swept?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the answer to your first question, have we begun implementing the sweep, is slightly complicated as anything becomes when you get into state accounting. What we've done at this stage is we've restricted expenditures on any appropriations made from sweepable funds that we can't show current year revenues. And that's that second attachment that came along with my PowerPoint that lists what those restrictions are effectively. And so it's, if a fund source is receiving $10 million in revenue, is a projection of revenue for the fiscal year, but $11 million in appropriations were made, we're restricting $1 million out of those appropriations to ensure that we don't overspend revenue in the fiscal year. The money in those funds, however, that will stay there until the accounting process is done. So once the annual comprehensive financial report is released and Ledge Audit audits it and releases their final audit finding, we'll know how much money needs to be moved into the CBR. So the actual transfer of cash doesn't happen until much later in the year.
Follow-up question, Senator Wilson?
Yes, and the other part was about anticipating a CBR why not just ask for the votes for the sweep instead of doing a fund source switch, as the budget originally included the money as indicated in the original funds designated that were sweepable accounts. Is the position of the administration changed to change it to just a general fund?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, thank you for reiterating your question. The administration's position hasn't necessarily changed. In December, we introduced a budget that included the reverse sweep. However, that wasn't enacted through the vote of the legislature. And so in this bill, we are going a different route to address these scholarship programs because the last attempt to introduce a reverse sweep vote did not pass. So we are trying a different route to address just those programs that impact individuals directly and immediately.
Okay, so in your expectation, how much time and Treasury is it going to take for you to, if we don't complete the reverse sweep, to go through this process and clean it up? Is there any extra work that your department is facing?
Senator Stedman, evaluating the impacts of the sweep and, working through these issues with agencies, has been, a lot of the work that my office has worked on over the last several months. Just as we implement the budget, in any given fiscal year, just implementing the budget involves a lot of work with the accounting staff and the budget staff of different agencies, but looking at the impacts of the sweep has added another layer onto that process this year. And so the document, this spreadsheet that you see is work product of many, many refinements over time. You'll note that this document looks a lot different than the one presented during session, and that's because over this intervening time period, we've been doing a lot more work on understanding these impacts. So I don't know that I could give you a total estimate of the hours that we've spent on this issue, but it's been significant.
Is it a cost savings, or is it going to cost you more in time and treasury?
Chair Stedman, I'm not sure that there would be cost savings from any of this. What we're looking at here really is just how do we operate these state programs in this sort of kind of post-sweep world.
So is the committee to expect a supplemental if there's no reverse sweep in January, or is there no budget impacts that we should concern ourselves with?
Chair Stedman, when you look at the list of programs, expect that the solutions for each individual program may be different. Whether it's something that requires a unrestricted general fund supplemental to backfill the money that was swept into the CBR, or an area where we were able to sort of tighten the belts on expenditures, and you may see, you know, a future budget that reflects that belt tightening process. But you won't see a supplemental for the time spent by OMB or by department accounting or budget staff, because that's simply part of our jobs is responding to and evaluating, you know, the issues that become present, whether they're sweep or something else in the state's accounting and budget world.
So with this added increased workload in your department, you're telling me you can absorb it no problem at all. So that tells me that you have too much flexibility within your budget. Walking into this year, anticipating that there would have been a reverse sweep. So I think we need to take further review of that as we go forward, if there's that much room within your organization. Because all of the other OMB directors I've talked to were very concerned of the extra workload dealing with the sweep issue when it got bogged down in politics. So we'll take a look at that. But I'm still not clear why the department is advocating in a special session for the reverse sweep, just to clean up the workload. And again, I'd like to remind the public that is watching that before the budget is submitted, your department scrubs all these accounts for excess funds, and we do the same once you give us the budget. So these are not accounts with just a lot of loose money laying around in them. So can you help me understand that?
Yes, Chair Stedman. First, what I'll clarify and ensure is understood is that we're spending time working on this issue means that we're not spending time working on other issues. So it's not necessarily that we had slack capacity that we are now devoting to looking at the reverse sweep. It means that there are other issues that we're not able to investigate further. Just like if I weren't here for this hour, I would be working on something else and not, you know, sitting around doing nothing. On the issue of reviewing these funds as we go through the budget development process, we do that, and that's actually why you see some of these holes as a result of the sweep. Some of these funds, for example, the Alcohol and Tobacco Substance Use Fund, that fund was significantly overcapitalized about 4 to 5 years ago, and so the legislature and the administration at the time engaged in a drawdown plan of that fund, over-appropriating current year revenue in each year to draw down the balance of the fund. What you see now is, while these appropriations would have been fine if that excess balance were still there, once that balance is swept, that intentional drawdown now becomes an over-appropriation of available revenue. And so these over-appropriations and these shortfalls really are a result of, you know, deliberate and thoughtful effort to draw down excess balances in DGF funds to reduce the burden on unrestricted general fund. And the sweep really has sort of, you know, thrown for a loop a couple of those intentional plans. But it does highlight really those operational issues in that, because rather than looking at those programs and looking at how we can restructure and maybe, you know, reduce the cost of those programs to meet the current year revenue, we instead sort of push that issue off into the future as those funds draw down. This highlights some of those issues, and that's why I say it's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all solution. You know, while we put forward the reverse sweep back in December, and we did and do support that, we see that now, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, that every program should be solved in that way. You know, we think that the scholarship programs and the educational grants, those are very important. Backfilling them with some restricted general fund makes sense. But some of these other programs with smaller shortfalls or intentional shortfalls, you know, really need to be evaluated on their own merits. And, you know, a special session without the subcommittee process, you know, isn't necessarily the right environment to have in-depth conversations about each one of these programs. So it's my expectation, and it should be yours as well, that we see proposals in the future coming into next session of how to address some of these issues with these programs. They're not even necessarily issues. That may be too pejorative of a term, but how to address the operational the operational realities of some of these programs to ensure that they're more durable, that they aren't reliant on fund balances and aren't reliant on over appropriations of revenue.
Mr. Chair, is it Senator Wilson?
Senator, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, on those numbers, Mr. Steiner, we have subcommittees that are using funds like the recidivism fund for DOC at $2.7 million. How are some of those gaps going to be filled going forward?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the use of things like recidivism fund and some of those gaps, especially in Department of Corrections, where you may not have, operational things that you can change necessarily to make up that big of a shortfall, may require unrestricted general fund backfills to ensure that we can still meet operational needs. Some of these funds really are, you know, excess balances that we've used in order to, you know, lessen the need for UGF in a given fiscal year, but those costs still remain. So it really is case by case how we would go about backfilling these or, you know, changing operational costs.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, for a follow-up?
Go ahead.
Then I guess we're looking at potential supplemental budgets going forth, but then do we have enough funds to pay our bills without having access to the CBR? Does the department still have access to CBR to borrow money with without that access of a vote?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that will be probably the largest challenge in trying to address these issues is if it requires access to the CBR, if it's in excess of available revenues. And one thing I'll note is a lot of these areas where we've over-appropriated designated general fund sources was done to reduce the UGF burden, to reduce the amount needed to draw from the CBR. So a lot of these areas will require some detailed conversations that will need the kind of robust public process of the subcommittee process and the general legislative process.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, I don't think you really answered the question. I guess the question would be, does the department or does the administration, to make sure our bills are paid and have adequate cash flow, do we need to do a CBR vote this session to make sure that occurs without going into deficit spending?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, there's currently enough of an unrestricted general fund surplus to address these issues, dependent upon what other appropriations are made. But currently, there is enough of a general fund surplus in fiscal year 22 to address these.
Okay. Is that right? Okay. And let's go back to the performance.
Chairman.
Performance scholarship. Wait, Senator Von Imhoff, you have a question?
I do. I just ahead. wanted Thank you. So just ask Mr. Steiniger, you had mentioned about, you know, the importance of perhaps cleaning up some of these designated funds. But I do recall that the administration's original budget this past December had well over $100 million scattered throughout the entire budget using designated funds as fund sources for a whole multiple of programs. But it seems now that the administration has pivoted off of that and has maybe changed their tune a bit. And then I have a follow-up question depending on how he answers. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator von Imhoff, we haven't necessarily changed our tune in how we put together a December budget. We're simply responding to, you know, the operational changes caused by not having a three-quarter vote. So because there was no three-quarter vote, we have to, you know, reassess how we go about funding these programs. And so it's not necessarily a change in that position. Will still be putting forward a budget that utilizes designated general funds because there will be designated general fund revenue, you know, in future years because those statutes are still on the books. You know, alcohol taxes still go to the alcohol fund. Marijuana taxes still go to recidivism reduction and marijuana education. You still have those flows of revenue, but with, you know, after the sweep occurs, we'll no longer have access to, you know, existing balances. So those appropriations will just have to be in line with revenue estimates for those different funds.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Well, I think what's interesting is if the administration truly does support a reverse sweep, that it would be nice to see a press conference that actually says that. But moving on, I also want to state that one of the events that occurred this year was the receipt of $505 million in COVID relief funds, the latest round, mind you. We have received much more than that. That was in cash this past spring, which I believe has had a material impact on this budget in a very positive way in terms of being able to fund many of these programs that have been vetoed or were not funded because of the reverse sweep. And it has given the administration and the legislature and the Alaskan public a cushion, if you will. And I think it's important to acknowledge that this is a one-time deal. It's not something that we can do every year, but it definitely occurred this year. And it is definitely helping us weather this storm. So thank you. I just wanted that on the record, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
So I'm a little bit concerned on the position of the administration on the reverse sweep. The Alaska Performance Scholarship account balance being swept, is there any loss of, is there any opportunity cost loss in portfolio difference, performance difference between the CBR and the and the scholarship, the way it's structured now?
Chair Stedman, yes. Without going too far out of my depths on, you know, investing in money management, what I'll say is the CBR is invested a lot more conservatively because the outlook of how much of that balance needs to be used for operations is large as a percentage of the overall fund. The Higher Education Investment Fund had a, well, smaller than the CBR, had a large balance compared to its annual appropriation need. And so it could be invested with a longer-term outlook. And so if it becomes part of the CBR, there will be a transition period where it begins to be invested more conservatively.
And the testimony yesterday was we're talking tens of millions in opportunity costs dealing with the lack of the reverse sweep from ledge finance. So this is a very expensive maneuver to the Treasury in net dollars. There's also a concern that the performance scholarship balance will just be in the CBR and spent. And that is a problem for some of us trying to control spending. So what you're telling me is that, or telling the committee, is the committee shouldn't expect that the administration is going to be pursuing a reverse sweep. That's that's your guys' position?
Chair Stemman, we've chosen in this bill, because reverse sweep did not pass in HB 69, we've chosen in this bill to pursue an alternate way to ensure those programs are funded. One thing I'll note, you know, the sweep is not a maneuver. It's a constitutional requirement. This isn't a choice being made to do this. This is something required by the Constitution that can only really be reversed with a three-quarter vote of both bodies of the legislature. So this isn't a maneuver by the administration in order to move these funds into the CBR. And if they are moved into the CBR, the vote threshold to spend them is actually higher than when they're seen in the higher education fund.
Right. I understand that. But the maneuver I'm talking about is the first year of the administration, they advocated a sweep of all kinds of funds, including these. And then the position reversed. And I'm not so sure the position ever really changed. That's the maneuver, political maneuver I'm talking about, not the constitutional obligation to pay back the debt owed to the general fund or owed to the CBR from the general fund. So there's a definite concern there, and there's a concern on our opportunity costs year by year, and especially when we, in the event that we liquidate that performance scholarship. Because the way to control spending is through cash flow, and we're up against our spending limit this year at a 5% draw rate, and a lot of people in the building didn't like that. We have any other, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the members of the committee fully understand the constitutional requirements of the reverse sweep. The question, I think, is how much energy is the administration going to do, if any, to garner the votes to assure that the reverse sweep takes place? You know, it's one thing to say the Constitution requires a three-quarter reverse sweep. I was on the Senate Finance House Finance Committee as a chairman when we wrote that constitutional amendment, so I don't need no education on what's required there. I fully understand that how much energy to put into any project determines the outcome. And the question that I have is how much energy is the administration going to spend to get that reverse sweep? Or is the administration, including your director's office, going to spend their time doing the accounting maneuvers and accept the fact that the reverse sweep did not happen?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I can't necessarily speak to, you know, political strategy, but I will say that, you know, we're here to help find solutions to ensure that these programs are funded and that there are not operational impacts. That's what we in my office have been working with agencies on to ensure we can identify those operational impacts. And yes, reversing the sweep is technically probably the most expeditious way to resolve these issues, but it may not be politically the most expeditious way. That's not necessarily a matter for OMB to weigh in on. We're here to try to resolve the operational issues that happen in the departments and encourage resolution to those issues.
Mr. Chairman, if I might continue. Thank you for that non-answer. Going back to the question that the chairman had regarding the opportunity costs, we are in the second month of this fiscal year, and it was reported yesterday, as the chairman noted, that there were some $20 million in opportunity costs that are being lost as a result of not having the reverse sweep. Regarding the educational components of the bill, why haven't you included lost opportunity costs to be reinstated in this bill, so that if the reverse sweep took place, those dollars would be available for further education of the citizens of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, The Office of Management and Budget did not put together those opportunity cost issues. That didn't come from the administration. These costs that we're talking about are still theoretical. The money in the Higher Education Investment Fund has not yet moved into the CBR. It is still separately managed in the Higher Education Investment Fund. That move won't happen until all of the accounting work is completed to determine the balance available for appropriation that would be swept into the CBR. That won't happen for some time. So those opportunity costs haven't happened yet. They're theoretical at this stage. But as noted by the chair, the CBR is invested more conservatively than the Higher Education Fund, so there would be some investment earning difference when it moves in. But it has not moved yet.
Just a point on that. If we don't reconvene, which is likely, between now and January, so you're telling me the sweep isn't going to take place till after January?
Chair Stedman, it depends upon the timeline of audit of the annual financial report, which in the last few years has been, early in the following calendar year, yes.
So we convene in January. This year they were late on their account balances, dealing with some of these accounts. I don't think we had the account balances on the sweepable items till into February. And they assured us last year that, they'd have it done quicker this year. So I would be surprised if those account balances aren't refined before February so they can get the audited financial statements out. So I would say that the opportunity cost may be so-called hypothetical, but the hypothetical opportunity cost is going to hit us right in the head here shortly when the transaction takes place. So these small group of legislators that want to block these maneuvers, and there's just a small group in the House, minority legislators, are costing the state tens of millions of dollars in their education of the finances of the state. That's the concern. And the other concern is that the legislature liquidates the $400 and some million that's going to be sitting there in cash once they get their hands on it. So, the concern at the table is to prevent those type of things from happening. It's hard enough to close the gap the way it is. So we have further questions on the reverse sweep from any of the members? Senator Hoffman, and then
Thank
Senator
you.
Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, going back to the school debt reimbursement program, 50%, I recall yesterday when we had the presentation by our director of finance, the number that was given was $4,125,000. What is the difference between the number here and the number that was presented for school debt reimbursement from the director of Ledge Finance and the number here? And the second question is, why is the administration treating the school debt reimbursement program, which is primarily a urban program, differently from the rural education attendance area, which is primarily a rural program? And the difference is significant, I think, 50%. Why would you treat people that are being educated in rural Alaska financially less than what is required by law, and those in urban Alaska financially more? What is the difference between educating somebody in Tuntutuliak versus somebody in Mat-Su?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we vetoed the REAA funding to 50% of the statutory calculation. The intention was also to veto school bond debt to 50%. However, the appropriation that came to the executive branch from the legislature was an appropriation of less than 50% of the calculation for school bond debt. And so no veto was made because the funding from the legislature was already below the amount proposed by the governor's office. And that's a result of use of sweepable funds and the lack of the three-quarter vote. The school bond debt appropriation came in the 45% of statutory range. So the funding for REAA is actually greater as a percent of the statutory calculation than that for school bond debt.
Then let me follow up on my second question, which is the Casale case. It's a court decision, a settlement between the Casale plaintiffs and the state of Alaska, saying that the state of Alaska agrees with the formula in the law that we had passed. Why, on one hand, you want to honor certain laws, but when you have a court decision, you want to fund it at 50%. It would seem to me when the court makes a decree and the plaintiffs agree to it, that you, the state of Alaska, would follow that decree or get that decree changed. Why are you not funding the full amount of the decree that was a settlement action with the court and the plaintiffs?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the statute that ties REAA funding to school bond debt reimbursement was a result of that Casale case. And REAA funding is a calculation based on the amount of school bond debt funding. So when we propose 50% school bond debt reimbursement funding, the calculation also results in 50% REAA funding. And so that's why you see that there is an attempt at parity to meet the intent of that case of funding REAA similarly to school bond debt reimbursement. And so that's what you see here, where we are attempting to keep those proportionally the same, not necessarily at the full calculation for school bond debt reimbursement.
Thank you for that, but I've had dialogue with some of the plaintiffs, and that's not their recollection. So I think both the administration and my office need to get to the bottom of this and make sure that we are following that decree. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just for clarity, in the budget, we funded those. The lack of the reverse sweep in the three-quarter vote to get access cut those payments down. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
And it's the same group of legislators from mainly MATSU. So as we move on into vetoes and adjustments, I'm kind of curious why the vetoes came from everywhere but MATSU. I see a list of projects that are going to be funded when the statutory budget reserve is not swept. And these projects weren't vetoed, but the other projects were vetoed, so they're dead, rather than just leave them unfunded. Can you help me explain why there's a geographical concentration in the governor's capital budget in one area of the state when this entire capital budget came from the administration? The legislature didn't add anything to the capital budget? Help me with the regional balance on that, if you could.
Chair Stedman, I don't know that I have information on the regional balance with me, but what I can tell you about the veto decisions, we vetoed projects that were funded with unrestricted general fund when we had proposed them to be funded with other funds, primarily the general obligation bond package. We felt that there is an opportunity to issue bonds to pay for those projects, but they weren't necessarily projects that we supported if just spent with general funds. We saw that benefit of low interest rates being an opportunity to fund a larger capital budget than normal. However, when those projects came to us funded with unrestricted general funds, rather than taking advantage of low interest rates, we chose to veto those. That was the primary reason for vetoing most of the capital projects that you see vetoed.
Page 2 of your backup?
Page 2 of my backup covers capital projects that are impacted by the result of a CBR vote failure. These are projects that were not vetoed, that are projects included in HB 69, but from fund sources impacted by the CBR vote failure.
So is these, some of these projects were in the bond package?
Chair Stedman, there, I believe a couple of these projects were originally in the bond package, and then when the bond package appeared not to be going forward through the legislative process, subsequent amendments were released to support them being funded with unrestricted general fund. But these are projects that were included in the capital budget using statutory budget reserve.
And the legislature is the appropriating body, and we choose the funding source. Isn't that not correct?
That is true, yes.
So that is our side of the aisle to work on, where we fund things from. And again, there's a regional balance concern here, where you have a very heavy concentration in one area of the state. It's glaringly apparent. I think in retrospect, absorbing all of the governor's amendments, which we took at this table clear up to the end for the capital budget without question and kept adding them into the capital budget, and there was a limited amount of money, so we had to keep shrinking the dividend, which ended up coming out at $1,100 before vetoes in short funding. And then the end result is an over-concentration in one area of the state, and I think that's unfortunate for the rest of the state. So we need to take a look at how we structure regional fairness. Can you give me an idea when you guys are going to make your decision on the SBR being swept or non-swept?
Chair Stedman, as a note on regional fairness, just because we are referring to this spreadsheet, I want to note that, again, this spreadsheet only represents those capital projects funded with sweepable funds. It doesn't represent the entire capital budget that was enacted. So there are projects in the rest of the capital budget, things like, surface transportation program and DOT that have a lot more regional distribution. These are projects that were funded with sweepable funds in the bill that came out of the legislature that are now subject to not being funded as a result of the lack of a three-quarter vote. So any application of regionality in this list, needs to be taken in context of the overall capital budget, not just projects funded with sweepable funds.
Most of the capital budget is federal match money through DOT and airports. We can certainly have the budget or the capital budget chairman pull the vetoes and do a comparison of the added amendments that were brought in and recommendations and do that comparison outside of the normal DOT process, because that's the vast majority of the capital budget, and even make it more glaringly apparent. So there is concerns there on regional fairness across the state.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
So one of the other things is, since we're on the subject of a bond package, Mr. Steininger, is there discussion in your department to resurrect the bond package, perhaps this next go around, in order to help fund these projects that have not been funded? What are your thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, while the bond package is still active legislation before the legislature, I think any discussions around how that's handled are part of the deliberative budget development process leading up to December 15th.
Mr. Chairman, follow up?
Yes.
It's with a lot of these projects being unfunded this year, and we're talking big road projects and bridges and ports and all sorts of stuff. Granted, the National Congress is debating an infrastructure fund, but I suspect that there's going to be state match for a lot of these. I mean, we don't really know, but, some of the conversations is that there will be some state money. Is that something that your department is considering, as at least as they're looking in the future, whether it be reverse sweep funds or CBR votes? How are we going to handle our capital needs? And provide the requires in order to. The governor vetoed well over $200 million in federal funds this year. I don't know why that happened. That's a rhetorical question, but I hope that the governor doesn't continue to veto federal funds coming in.
Okay, it's been garbled up, Senator Von Imhoff, but one of the questions was the federal fund, veto of federal funds for DOT. Maybe you can help the committee understand that.
Chair Stemmin and Senator Von Imhoff, so there was a veto of contingency funds in the Surface Transportation Infrastructure Program in DOT. They were federal funds in excess of the amount that the department expected to receive. And so they were vetoed just as excess federal funds. Some of that contingency was left, and we're evaluating how much is actually needed. The amount that was included we felt was greater than the amount necessary to achieve the mission of the department. Related to the currently discussed infrastructure program at the federal level, I will say we do, you know, keep an eye on that and are discussing it on a frankly daily basis, and that will definitely play a role in how we address the capital budget in December 15th or on December 15th.
On, you have a question, Senator?
I've got a lot to say.
Okay, good. Senator, I was wondering when you were going to speak up.
I'm ready to roll.
Okay, Senator Bishop.
Well, I know you're just a messenger, so I'm not going to give you an earful, because I've worked for an administration, and I get the company line. But I got to call Bravo Sierra on a little bit of that last comment on the $250 million, because you sat in that office with us and your staff, with DOT and Senator Stedman, to get truth in budgeting on these highway funds. So I'm just going to leave that at that point. The other thing I'm going to say is on this capital budget sweep list, you were talking about the bond list and how we could sell bonds to pay for it, but there's a 1, 2, 3 items in the SBR that came right off the bond list, so that dog don't hunt with me either. And the other thing I'll say is, have you had any conversations internally in light of the court ruling where you on footnote 77 were, as Senator Stedman alluded to earlier, all these SBR-funded projects could come to pass? I'm done.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, related to the SBR and the outcome of the Alaska Federation of Natives case on power cost equalization, that case was specific to PCE in its ruling and its direction. However, as you've noted, there is a question of whether that can be applied to the statutory budget reserve. That's a pretty significant fundamental change in the way of thinking about which funds sweep. The statutory budget reserve has always been on our list of sweepable funds, and so we're working with law right now to understand, you know, how that analysis applies, how the AFN case applies to our determinations of sweepability. But it is a pretty significant shift, the kind of test, if you will, implied by the AFN case is a pretty significant shift. So we haven't made a determination as to whether or not we think it applies to the SBR, but we are having those conversations.
So let's just assume that the SBR is not swept. I think that's probably likely. All these projects come alive. But also what was testified to yesterday, if the governor had not vetoed the already reduced dividend from $1,100 to $525 from the House minority mainly, then he vetoed the other $525. If he did not veto that appropriation, the dividend right now as we sit today with the SBR not being swept would be $1,025. Do you concur with that, or And that was a testimony from Ledge Finance yesterday, and we had him repeat it a couple of times to make sure we understood what he was saying.
Chair Stedman, I think the problem with that reasoning is that at the time those vetoes were made, nobody believed that the SBR was not subject to the sweep. It was an item that had been subject to the sweep and considered subject to the sweep, you know, in every year that the sweep had been applied. And so at that point, there was no reason to believe that that was an appropriation with revenue backing it. And so, you know, that I would not characterize that as Governor vetoing an $1,100 dividend, because at that time, you know, the knowledge, the argument being put forward by the Department of Law in a court, an active court case at that time, was that funding was swept or would be swept without that three-quarter vote. And so, you know, I don't think it's fair to characterize the veto that way.
Okay, so that, just for clarity, you misspoke, and just want to correct the record. The governor did not veto 1,100. He vetoed 5 1/4. There was the difference between 5 1/4 and, I think, 1,100. That was the funding was reduced from the lack of the reverse sweep, or the CBR draw. So, but the concern is the mechanical fallout. But that clearly would be the result today, foreseen or not foreseen, on the SBR if it's not swept. And I would be shocked if the SBR is swept, looking at the list of the impacts of what's going to be funded with the SBR. So I would expect that will not be swept. Do we have other questions concerned on the SBR, and then we'll go on to a couple other issues and finish up before Mr. Steininger's hair completely catches on fire and he runs out the door. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your logic of the SBR always being swept, therefore you assumed that it was going to be swept, how does that logic follow with the permanent fund earnings recount when it was never on the list and has never been swept? Therefore, the administration, under your logic, should assume that it would not have been swept, but it was added to the list. How is that logic? But I would like to thank the administration for not appealing the court decision. But your logic doesn't follow through on your arguments that the CBR was swept. Therefore, you reduced the dividend to zero when the power cost equalization program was never swept and probably would never have been swept. What was the logic and the disparity between those two thoughts?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, thank you for that question, because at the time that PC was determined to be sweepable a couple years ago, we applied a test. We worked with law to formulate a test that we could apply to funds to determine whether or not they were subject to the sweep. That test looked at whether it was available for appropriation with a simple majority vote, whether it was unobligated or could be spent without appropriation, whether or not it was defined as being part of the permanent fund or the constitutional budget reserve. And through that test laid out in that Attorney General memo, the power cost equalization fund was determined to be sweepable. What we have today is a new test implied by the AFN decision that is a little bit different and adds different considerations that weren't considered under that Attorney General memo. And that's causing us to sort of reassess that test that we had applied then and the test that we apply now. So the statutory budget reserve, under the former test and kind of under any test done before, it was available for appropriation. You know, it's managed with the general fund assets by the Treasury. It is, not part of the CBR. It is not part of the permanent fund. And so it always had been determined by any prior test as being subject to the sweep. This AFN decision introduces a new concept of whether or not the statutory framework establishing the fund states where it's located. And now for the SBR, that sort of changes that sort of decision tree, if you will. It also changes the decision tree for the power cost equalization fund and very directly addresses that fund itself. So the test was applied in 2019 that determined PC to be sweepable. That test has now changed as an outcome of the AFEN decision. And now that that test has changed, we have to look at these other funds. And it's making us reconsider sort of long-held understandings of what is and isn't sweepable. And that determination is going to take some time to work through with the Department of Law. But it is just a simple change in the application of the legal test that's at hand.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the most important test that you have not mentioned that the Attorney General should have taken into consideration was the Hickel versus Cooper. The most important consideration, which I think the courts looked at. Why wasn't that simple decision receiving the most important weight in your determination? You didn't even mention that. Was that court case even considered by your Attorney General in making the determination on why it should not be swept? It doesn't make sense to me.
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, the Attorney General memo from Attorney General Clarkson did reference the Hickel v. Cooper case as part of their justification for establishing the tests that they gave us to apply to funds. So very much so was part of the supporting legal background that informed the test that was established in that memo. This new case, this AFN case, kind of changes and adds a new interpretation that we're now having to apply to funds. So very much so Hickel v. Cooper was incorporated into our analysis both in 2019 and today.
Yeah, I think a lot of us agree with Senator Hoffman that we had years of history going back multiple governors and multiple legislatures on how that's treated. It wasn't until this administration came in its first year and decided it wanted to consolidate all liquid assets and gather more to do whatever political objective you guys were going after. So, and leverage rural Alaskans for a political philosophy or ideology that is still being played out today. So that doesn't go unnoticed at the table. The politics behind this, and it was unfortunate. We have other questions on that subject. We've got the budget deposit of $3 billion. And I know your $3 billion is broken up in 1.47 plus, the 1.503, I guess. Could you, again, come back and help me understand why the committee should advance well in excess of $1 billion, and here $3 billion, for a cash flow need that's not apparent today? And might not even be ripe in May, and it may not be ripe till the following May or later, depending on the fiscal results of the economy. Help me understand that.
Through the chair, or Chair Stedman, the proposal for the $3 billion bridge fund and the 50-50 dividend, both are in SB 3001 in support of the other constitutional amendments. We recognize that those...
Can you stop and name the constitutional amendments? Because I'm not sure if they're all included or if there's just one included or what. Could you help me with that?
Yes, Chair Stedman, the constitutional amendments are the primary, the primary objective of this special session from the administration's perspective is instituting a structural reform to the state's finances. SB 3001 is a supporting bill to go alongside those. So we are not suggesting that the $3 billion bridge fund be enacted without consideration of those constitutional amendments. The $3 billion bridge fund in SB 3001 only really supports those constitutional amendments if implemented. It's only required if they're implemented because those constitutional amendments would have the effect of dramatically limiting the state's access to assets. And so that transfer needs to occur in order for this all to work. They should be considered as a package together. 3001 is not its own vehicle.
What are they? I want you to name them.
The constitutional amendments?
Yeah. What's the ones that are tied to it, and then we assume the other ones aren't tied to it?
So the items tied to this, you have the SBR 6, which rolls the earnings reserve into the corpus of the permanent fund. It also brings a PC into the corpus of the permanent fund to protect both. It then constitutionalizes a 5% draw, and it constitutionalizes the dividend. But by protecting the earnings reserve and the PCE into the corpus of the permanent fund, all we can access then is that 5%, which that ensures that that fund is there for the future. But it also means that we need access to liquid assets to keep the state operating during the intervening time period while we either implement budget reductions or add revenues in order to bring the state into balance.
Okay, and isn't there a vote of the people on taxes? Is that tied into this or not?
That item is not on the call, so of the special session. So the other item is the reform to the constitutional spending limit. That's another piece of the overall fiscal plan that is what I talked about a little bit earlier about avoiding a run-up in expenditures. And we are very happy to bring, Commissioner Mahoney, myself, anyone else into this room to discuss those constitutional amendments and have an in-depth discussion on the details, show you the modeling, run scenarios for you, show how those work together, and to show why we think this $3 billion transfer is the amount necessary, and all of the other details surrounding those so that we can look at that and have a robust discussion on those elements of the fiscal plan, because like I said, that's really what the administration is here to do in this special session.
So these take priority over the dividend, and so the bill in front of us, 3001, is, I don't want to call it chopped liver, but it's not the priority bill this special session. You're asking us to pivot to the constitutional amendments?
Chair Stedman, the constitutional amendments address the dividend, and the idea here is that we address the dividend in the way that it is, creates a structure where it's rules-based and can continue and be reliable into the future. And so this appropriation bill would be implementing the dividend laid out in the constitutional amendment we would put forward to the voters.
Okay. And then there's a clause in your Section 6 of your bill. I don't understand what that is. Section 6.
Chair Stedman, Section 6 is a retroactivity clause to ensure that the appropriations in Section 4, which are the transfer and the dividend transfer, are retroactive to July 1st, 2021.
And why is that in there? I thought there was issues we had in the last budget bill. We put retroactive language in there in the event that the effective date failed, and to make it clear in the appropriation bill when the starting time was July 1st, not 90 days after implementation. So can you help me understand why the structure that we put in and have put in appropriating bills for years, and we have numerous governors and legislatures that have operated under the same precedents, but this year it was something different. It wasn't, was it needed? It was referred to as a defective bill, when in fact it was a bill that would have given you a balanced budget. It would have given an $1,100 dividend. It would have given all the capital projects the governor asked for, all of his amendments he asked for, and it would have set the legislature up to come back in October and talk about rewriting the formula. So why should we put a retroactive clause in any piece of legislation for this administration?
Chair Stedman, that's a fair question that I would possibly want to defer to Department of Law and their drafting. What I can tell you is Section 7, that this act takes effect immediately, that section would require a two-thirds vote of both bodies to be effective, since it is otherwise the bill would not be effective for 90 days. And we would not be able to begin expenditures on these appropriations for 90 days after the date the bill was signed if Section 7 does not receive a two-thirds vote. Whether or not a retroactivity clause then becomes superfluous to that vote is an excellent question for the legislative drafters, but as explained to me by Department of Law, Section 7 is the more pertinent section that requires the two-thirds vote.
So the retroactive clause in the appropriation bill that we put in all the time, every year, is to make it clear that you don't have to wait 90 days on an appropriation bill. And we have till the end of June to hand it to the governor. We normally try to hand it to the administration early June, in May, somewhere along there, to give the administration time to look at it, make their decisions, go through their veto process, the review process, all that stuff, so we can have an orderly transition from fiscal year to fiscal year. Yet this administration decided to take a completely different tact, dissimilar to all other governors in statehood that I know of, that, you know, they'd be enabled to implement the budget for 90 days. I thought that was a laughable argument and frankly embarrassing to see a governor stand there and make, to try to leverage all the citizens of the states, the operating budget, against his ideological endeavor of his constitutional amendments. So I guess we'll talk about retroactive dates. We'll see if the committee puts them in or not. But we have the constitutional obligation to give you a bill by the end of June. We do not have the constitutional obligation to give you retroactive dates. So we'll work that out this winter and see how we want to phase from one fiscal year to the other. But one of the first things that elected officials should consider when being before getting elected, or particularly after getting elected, is do no damage. And in particular, do no intentional damage. So we have some of the significant concerns on the new interpretation of decades of precedents from this administration. But I would like to thank you and the administration for not vetoing the $4 billion that this committee had a hand in recommending, that we take $4 billion from the earnings reserve that is spendable and put it in the constitutionally protected portion of the permanent fund for all future generations of Alaskans. So in the event that we are unable to prevent liquidation of the ERA, as we saw here with the CBR, our savings account, and we walked through, $12 billion there, plus another few billion, $16 billion total, that we don't get up one morning and find out that most of our permanent funds have been spent, because it was easier to do that than make harder decisions. So I'm hoping that this committee will look forward again in April, May timeframe, and consider an additional recommendation into the budget for the other body to review and concur with, that we continue to build the constitutionally protected portion of the permanent fund to block the permanent fund from being spent by the spendthrifts that we inevitably have in and out of the building, both elected and unelected. And I don't know what that number is going to be. We'll have to see what the markets look like and what the earnings reserve balance is and what we're doing. But that'll be a contribution, although a smidgen smaller than the one on the wall at $4.9 billion, it's still the two biggest contributions ever to be made to the permanent fund. And that's something that the legislature and the administration should be very proud of. That's $8.9 billion, over 10% of the value of the permanent fund in a couple of years. And it was the active position of this committee that made sure that that issue was on the table, and we worked with the body down the hall and in conjunction with them this year on it. So of all the indigestion that we may have with some of the vetoes and the, you know, the imbalance around the state, these two appropriations a couple of years ago at 4.9 and this one at 4 clearly benefits everybody in the state and all future Alaskans. So no matter how it happened and went through the process at the governor's or the administration side, in the end, it took effect. And that's the most important thing. It was unfortunate that there was an attempt to front run it and block that, because clearly the citizens of the state would have been the losers, and they should be the winners. So I just wanted to point that out, and the internal issue we have with retroactive dates and the concern with the administration having them in bills and then getting behind the podium and railing about them, or working with the capital budget chairman through a process to do truth in budgeting, and in the end, there's something totally different coming out of the administration. So when the administration's at the table, when we're working this, so it makes it difficult for all people in the room as we work through these issues to try to come up with a fairness. And I'm hoping that the capital budget chairman still keeps an open mind this next winter when we sit down with the capital budget and we try to do regional fairness around the state. And I'm hoping also that the administration reconsiders their lackadaisical position on the reverse sweep. And the reason I say that is we've pointed it out at this committee numerous times over the last 3 years, the difficulty that a lack of a reverse sweep is for those employees, state employees, that have to clean up the mess. It consumes a lot of time and a lot of treasury when you and your staff could be working on much more important things. The administration's constitutional amendments or spending caps or budgets, whatever you want to work on. There is no more leverage against the rural legislators to hold 82,000 people hostage around the state of their basic electric needs. That's gone. That was fixed by the courts. We have to deal with our education whammy and the education scholarship issues, and that can be appropriated fairly easily here at the table while we sort that out if we have to for a couple of years. But what it comes down to is this committee, I don't think, is going to take a lot of concern with the lack of a reverse sweep. If the administration wants to have endless financial messes, be my guest. You know, there's going to be no leverage against the sitting members of this committee on any of those funds involved in that reverse sweep. And I'm hoping that there will be enough legislators that didn't support it that realize all it's doing is costing the state tens of millions of dollars in lost opportunity cost of their portfolio and manpower. That's going to be hard to pinpoint, but clearly it's significant. And we go on. And it'll end up a perfunctory vote like it has been for years until this administration came in. And we just did the reverse sweep this as easy as we do an adjournment or ask for a recess. You just do it. OMB is scrubbing the numbers all the time, Ledge Finance is, and both finance committees every year on those accounts. So I'm hoping we can work together and trying to put a budget document together going forward that isn't deficient or laughable, because I think that type of terminology doesn't benefit anybody. And clearly, when people realize that there'd be a $1,025 dividend, if there was no dividend veto, it even questions why a $525 dividend would have been vetoed. So hang on, we're going to have a wild ride till May. But maybe we'll be out of here in April. We'll see. We have any questions, comments for the OMB director from any of our members? Okay, with that, I'd like to thank the OMB director for coming forward. Mr. Steiner, I know you work hard. You've got as Senator Bishop said, you got to ride for the brand. And sometimes the brand might change direction on you, and you're still on the horse. So we understand that, and we do think you do a good job. So don't misinterpret, my comments in that regard, because we do work and have good meetings with OMB, and always have, and I hope we will in the future. So with that, we'll end this meeting. We will schedule bills previously heard tomorrow. We'll let you know what the schedule is when the committee makes a schedule. And thank you, Mr. Steininger, for coming in and sitting in the hot seat for a few hours, a lot longer than I'm sure you hoped for. And thank you. We are adjourned.